when I started researching this book, I would come across some early statistics. They're all staggering. I think that's what it is. 30 million Americans approximately will have an eating disorder in their lifetime. And that's a number that most of the experts I spoke with think is a lowball. It's not quite accurate. Every 52 minutes, someone dies as a direct result of an eating disorder. That women, it affects women, it affects men too. Men absolutely get eating disorders, but women at 2 times the rate.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
My name is Cole Kasdan. I'm a journalist and an eating disorder survivor, a fact that I no longer hide because I'm author of the new book, What's Eating Us? Women, Food, and the Epidemic of Body Anxiety.
Cole, welcome to the podcast. I am so pleased that you were able to do this and talk about such an important topic that so many people suffer from and don't even realize it because it is just a norm. I'm going on a diet, I'm looking after this, I'm looking after that. And the origin of it is forgotten. It's not noticed. And the stigma we have in today's world of fat shaming, of body shaming, of skinny shaming. You know, it's not just people who are obese that we look at and all of a sudden make a, you know, our perception is, oh, they should be on a diet. They don't take care of themselves. There are people who look like they haven't eaten in years, and that could just be their body. But we want to get into the whole whole eating disorder. So the first thing I want to do is, while you were doing this, what was one of the most surprising statistics that you discovered?
I mean, first of all, I want to say I'm so happy we're having this conversation because not enough people are, and I want to keep a conversation going and loud. So I'm really grateful to be talking with you. I think when I started researching this book, I would come across some early statistics. They're all staggering. I think that's what it is. 30 million Americans approximately will have an eating disorder in their lifetime. And that's a number that most of the experts I spoke with think is a lowball. It's not quite accurate. Every 52 minutes, someone dies as a direct result of an eating disorder. That women, it affects women, it affects men too. Men absolutely get eating disorders, but women at 2 times the rate. So let's talk about women. I'm a woman. That was my experience. And that was kind of the lane I chose to be in. Women in their 80s have eating disorders. I mean, so I'm not trying to dodge the question by choosing a bunch of statistics over just one. But once you sort of start peeling this away, the statistics, which are not secrets, anyone can, you know, go online and see them right now. I thought, number one, I'm far from the only one wrestling with what I was wrestling with. But number two, why aren't we talking about this the way we talk about anxiety, depression, opioid overdose? I mean, eating disorders have one of the highest mortality rates of any mental illness. We're not talking about it, hardly at all. A little bit, but hardly at all.
Just a little, because most people don't accept the fact they have an eating disorder. They just think they're out of control. They need to go on a diet. Unfortunately, with social media, it's made it even worse. You have people going in for procedures to look to have their social media presence, diets, you know, fads, and so on. And every time we say the word diet, we're, you know, it's really, you're restricting yourself from something, you're depriving yourself from something. You know, even when they say, oh, you can eat whatever you want. Remember years ago in the 80s, everyone ate a Caesar salad because it was supposedly healthy. Well, come to know, not really. Or chocolate raisins. So what? They died a little bit healthier, but obese. I mean, it's just something that is there. So why don't you, since we're talking about it, and a lot of people, you know, don't realize they have it, can you describe the basics of what an eating disorder is?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so tricky because even the scientific and medical fields haven't perfectly defined eating disorders, which kind of leaves the rest of us like, well, what do we do with that? Right. So there are what I call, and I'm not meaning to be glib with this, but I call them the greatest hits eating disorders, the ones that most of us are familiar with, anorexia nervosa, where someone is severely restricting, reaching a dangerously low weight. There's bulimia, where people are purging, binging foods and then purging. And then there's binge eating disorder, which involves eating unusually large amounts of food and not purging. But there is such a spectrum of other disorders, and most of them are classified into this kind of unsatisfying category called other specified feeding and eating disorders. It's OSFED is the name of that. And that's kind of everything else. And that's where most people who go to seek help for eating disorders, who go to community clinics for eating disorders, same number of people who die from eating disorders. Most people are in that kind of catch-all OSFED category. And I'll give you an example of that. In my own experience, I purged food, but I didn't binge. So that makes me not officially diagnostically bulimic. I would get an asparagus salad, be terrified of digesting it, gaining any weight, would purge that asparagus salad. So that doesn't really qualify it a bit as a binge. They kind of put me into a bulimic category because I was purging. But again, not really the quote unquote official diagnosis. You have people who starve themselves constantly, but may not reach the low weight that is required to meet the diagnostic definition of an anorexic, but they are in every way anorexic except for what they weigh. And that's called atypical anorexia, which is a really kind of unsatisfying and even, I would argue, offensive category because it's saying you're not thin enough to be a real anorexic, essentially. So there's all this, all right, these spectrums, right, of what disordered eating behaviors are. And then you have the more normalized disordered behaviors, which may not qualify as an eating disorder, but are harming you. So if you are cutting out a particular food very deliberately, if you are making an effort to lose weight, if you are compulsively exercising, a lot of those behaviors are viewed as not only normal, but great. You just spent 2.5 hours at the gym. That's amazing.
Yeah, but you're amazing. You use the word compulsive, and I think that's the difference.
But if a person doesn't think it's compulsive.
Right. But now we start thinking about what is compulsive. Now we start looking at behaviors that really are compulsive. Somebody who can't live without going to the gym 7 days a week for 2.5, 3 hours, that's compulsive. And again, it's restrictive. Mm-hmm. Because restricting themselves from doing anything else, this is a must-have. This is on their list of, I can't live without it. I'm not doing good things to my body.
You know, and then you have the, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Then you have the more insidious ones. Like, I live in Los Angeles, so I have a lot of friends that don't eat bread. And they say they do it for health reasons. And none of them have been told by a doctor to stop eating bread. There is nothing about bread that they are, you know, allergic to in a real way. And that's about weight loss. That's code for weight loss. And they're just not eating bread. So those people might not have an eating disorder, but that is disordered eating. If you are manipulating the way you eat or move to change your body, make it smaller, that is a non-peaceful relationship with food and movement. If you are consciously, I cannot eat that, I cannot eat that, I can eat that, that is a stressful relationship with food.
Well, you just used a key word, and that is stress. And stress leads to so much. Stress leads to overeating, stress leads to undereating, stress leads to so many disorders. talk us through how did you go about realizing you had a food eating disorder, or when did you? Because from what I know, you grew up in a house, your father ate healthy, you didn't have processed foods per se in your house. So when did this begin?
Well, I will say that, you know, the research points to eating disorders being really complicated, and you'll often never get to the origin of the why. So sometimes it's family, sometimes it's trauma, sometimes it's biology. Often it's a combination of all of these things. For me, when I was younger, I was a dancer, and that is not necessarily a place that's going to give you an eating disorder. But if you have any of those behaviors, it gives you a lot of wind at your back. You're smoking cigarettes, eating grapes, drinking Diet Coke, and you're dancing. So it is going to foster an unhealthy relationship with consuming food and resting for me. Some people take to it better than others. I took to that pretty well. I think that when I got older, these behaviors worked. Meaning they kept me at a low weight that I desired to be at, right? Again, a lot of wind at our back in our culture for that. As I got older, as I stopped dancing, if I gained weight, then I turned to throwing up after eating. And that worked. And when you are doing something, well, I'll only speak to myself. When I was doing something that was pretty extreme, I put that in a category of pretty extreme, I knew something was wrong. But everyone was telling me I looked great. People were asking me what my secret was. I barely ate during the day. And if I had to eat in front of people, that's when I would eat. That's when I would go home, make sure I ran home and threw up. So not only am I getting positive reinforcement from the outside world, I really feel like I figured out a system to control my weight.
In fact, it was a system where there were times where you were anxious about going into a situation because you had to eat to look, in quotes, normal. Mm-hmm. In some of these social situations. And it turned you into being, it turned out to be a very stressful time.
And I was able to sustain it for, you know, unfortunately, my own demise, a very long time. And I think a part of me knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't think it was that bad. But the thing about eating disorders is the life and death piece of it often happens quickly and without warning. So people can sustain these behaviors and say, I don't feel bad. I'm sure I'm fine. I'll wait till it gets worse to get help. And then they have a heart attack. It happens fast. And so that's why it's really important that we get on these things as early as possible. Talk about them, attend to them, because it happens fast.
Well, tell us about the diet industry and what is out there, because I remember when I was younger, it was Weight Watchers and you mm-hmm. weighed your food. And believe me, I couldn't eat the amount of food that they wanted you to eat. Then there was the Atkins diet. And then there was, you know, all these crazy. And now we have even more of that. We have diet industry companies like Noom. Going out there and you have an app and it's supposed to do this and it's supposed to do that. And now you have Weight Watchers. They had a point system. Now they're even going to start adding in pharmaceuticals into this. So where do you see the diet industry / what they call themselves now, the health industry?
I mean, that's what's so scary about it. You said it. It's the health industry now. And can I swear on this podcast?
Sure.
It's all the same shit.
Yes.
It's all the same shit. And so you have some companies saying we're about health, and the pairing with pharmaceutical companies is terrifying to me, because what I think is so important and so difficult to do is separate weight from health. There is a massive amount of research, to support that diets do not work. Not work meaning a diet of restricting your food on one of these weight loss plans will not result in lost weight for long term. There's just so much research. It's not even, it's boring to talk about. It's boring. There's so much research. It's like, it kind of ends the conversation. Most of the people who go to these programs are repeat customers. It's where they get most of their business. So if they're that means it's not working, right? So we have this cognitive dissonance, all of us. And I think part of it even, and I have so much compassion for myself and other people who have gone down that diet road, right? Because if you say diets don't work, if you say that weight loss companies posing as health and wellness are nefariously trying to separate you from your money and you will not benefit health or weight loss wise, right? Whatever your goals happen to be. But let's be real, most of us use health as proxy for weight loss. Then you kind of say, I'll use myself as an example to not call anyone else out. How much money have I spent on prepackaged meals, points, trials for weight loss program? You know, since I was however old, I don't even know. How much money have I spent on cottage cheese, on a certain exercise class, on a personal trainer? I don't even want to think about that. And if someone tells me then that all of this is me really being taken advantage of, then I feel kind of foolish. But I don't want people to feel foolish if they've spent thousands of dollars on diets, because it's not their fault. It's not my fault. It's not your fault. It's not anyone's fault. We have people spending, companies spending billions of dollars lying to us. So we haven't fallen for anything. We have been really, really, really lied to. And when they add doctors to the mix, when some of these people from weight loss companies have doctors sitting on their board, we want information. We want to be healthy. We want to have energy. We want to keep up with our friends, our children, whoever we want to keep up with. And we want to be healthy and feel good. And so when a doctor is, or someone in a lab coat sitting there next to them, we believe it, not because we're foolish, but because we live in a culture that perpetuates this. And so it's never too late to turn that around, to flip that.
So there is, you know, there is a difference between being in that culture and depriving yourself and looking to be healthy. We don't want to take away the fact that there are certain things we need to do to stay healthy. And what we eat is one of them. I mean, if we sit there and just eat processed food or stuff with sugar and cut everything else out, we're not going to be healthy. If we don't get up and walk or a little bit of exercise or maybe whatever it is, we're not healthy. So there is a difference. So what do you tell people who are, because you interviewed quite a number of people in your book, how do they go about distinguishing? How do you go about distinguishing being healthy and not depriving yourself, but having that mix where, sure, you can eat, you know, you can have a slice of pizza or a couple slices of pizza. You can work out because it's a thing to do, but it's not an obsession. It's not done for reasons that, you know, we're told we need to look this way. We're supposed to be this way. How do you delineate between that?
Right. It's a great question. And the researchers I spoke with, the answer is not sexy. It's kind of boring. Mm-hmm. Get a great night's sleep. Number one, sleep. Really get solid sleeps. If you can work more vegetables into your diet, that's great. Move a little bit. See if you can do something about minimizing stress. That is, according to researchers I spoke with, just a baseline a baseline. You know, a lot of people don't have access to a farmer's market. So right. telling those people not to eat processed foods, that may be all they have access to, right?
That's very true.
So we want to say to people, if you are eating kale because you really love kale, and I told you that eating kale would make you healthy, meaning your blood would have more oxygen, right? Or whatever. I'm kind of grabbing right. thin air just for the example, but you would also gain 10 pounds, but you would be healthier.
We know what would happen to 90% of the people, if not 95% of the people.
Right. So I don't know. I think that, you know, so many of us don't know where our body wants to land in terms of weight. This idea of just like, I'm going to eat 3 meals a day, do my best, maybe have a snack and see what happens. What?
It's like closing insane. Your eyes and wishing for a miracle or rubbing it's the insane. Genie.
You know, like you don't know, you know, a lot of people may not know what their genetic weight is, where their body wants to land and where their body doesn't care if you fit into something you wore in college or not. Like your body is not thinking about that at all.
But it's so many people's goal, unfortunately.
But when we think about stress, you know, minimizing stress is one thing that we can may have the most control over, according to one researcher I spoke with. And that's something that we don't focus on in the same way we focus on food. But if we are really thinking about health, honestly, stress would be the number one thing to look at, I think, according to the researchers I spoke with.
Well, stress is the cause of so much in our lives, so much downfall as to what happens to us. So let's talk about treatment, because I know you went for treatment. You wanted to get better. When did you realize that you needed to get better?
Well, I met my now husband and I was living a double life, essentially. I was Cole with an eating disorder, meticulously, compulsively, doing all these harmful behaviors. And I had met this lovely man that I had started to date. And when it became more serious, I thought about getting help many times over the years. And I would take online quizzes for treatment centers. Do you have an eating disorder? Well, answer was always yes. There was never any debate. But something about meeting this man made me, I didn't want to have any secrets. I didn't want to go into the relationship with secrets. And I had such a big one. And that was kind of the thing that pushed me to start getting treatment and took me in that direction. I mean, I'm glad I didn't know what I know now about treatments being so often incomplete and not fully working, but it's important to get any sort of treatment, I believe, as long as it's not going to do harm. But that was the thing that pushed me into treatment was meeting this person, which I look back at now, having done so much research. And one of my biggest takeaways for getting better and sustaining recovery, I discovered, was the role of community in people's lives. And whatever that means, it doesn't have to be an eating disorder support group. It can be one other person. And when I look at the impact of community on people, you know, women I interviewed about how they sustain their recovery, I kind of look at how I began on this road to healing myself. And in a way, you can call your partner your community. And that was the start for me. You know, that was the start for me.
I think that's true, as you mentioned, of just about anything, whether yeah. it's illness, whether it's stress, whether it's grief, whether it's happiness. I mean, you need at least one other person around to not just validate you, but someone you could talk to, someone who could understand, a non-judgmental
yes.
place. And that's yes. that's very, because we are so judgmental. We jump to conclusions, we jump to perceptions. I mean, we started off by talking about, you know, the body shaming. Somebody's obese, somebody's anorexic. And we use that term, and we use both terms without knowing anything about the people themselves. As you said, and I know that one of your pet peeves is the fact that eating disorders are not treated like the mental illness they are, mm-hmm. as so many other mental illnesses are treated. Weight is not considered a class. So yeah. what in the world we live in, you know, we wanted healthy eating for our children. The schools were going to have healthy eating. That was thrown out. They didn't like the lettuce. They didn't like this. We have social media that is bombarding us. I believe that one of the stats is nearly half of American children between first and third grade want to be thinner. First and third grade. I mean, what do they know about size and weight? That is so disturbing amongst everything else that that we've talked about. And mm-hmm. Black teenage girls are 50% more likely than white girls to exhibit bulimic behavior. I mean, it's just so, it is a disease that is out there that we don't talk about enough because we lump it into they're not taking care of themselves. Oh, you know, they're just, you know, it's a one-off. And as you said, it's not.
And I think as a culture, we're so deeply invested in weight, in that number. And I think that we have to begin to separate ourselves from that, even as individuals and within our community. I think that even, for example, someone in a larger body who goes into the doctor and the first thing the doctor will say is that you need to lose weight for your health. Well, that's not fair. Because we know that diets don't work. We got all that research. So when a doctor is prescribing weight loss, they are harming that person potentially. Now let's say, but the person really does need to lose weight. They need to lose weight. They are in a large body. They are a walking time bomb. Absolutely not. There are behavioral changes that that person might be able to incorporate if they're not doing that already. So for example, if that person's not maybe walking, that could be really good for their body. A little movement is really great for the body. And that could be something that a doctor could prescribe that may result in zero weight loss, but will improve that person's, say, blood work numbers, health potentially. So I think that we have to really separate ourselves from that number in every setting. In the medical setting, in every setting, to really look at not how someone presents from the outside, but unless they're undernourished and they need to restore their weight, which is with a lot of anorexic patients. But if we're looking at someone that a doctor's telling to lose weight, that does not help that person.
Well, you know, one of the things also is that the doctor needs to not just look at the numbers, but ask them about what their routine is. What do they do? What mm-hmm. do they eat? If someone tells you they're eating 5 burgers at a sitting, well, you know, then there's all this behavioral change that can go with it. The walking, the maybe don't eat 5, maybe substitute it with something less. But it's not a general thing. As you say, you walk into a doctor's office and the first thing they want you to do is stand on the scale. Mm-hmm. When I was pregnant with my first and they said they were going to weigh me, I said, fine, but you never tell me what it is because there's nothing I can do about it. And there's nothing I'm going to do about it right now. You tell me I need to eat 3 meals for the health of the baby. Well, you think I'm going to stop what I've been doing before? Not happening.
That's brilliant. I mean, that's actually a brilliant thing to say when you're not pregnant to a doctor. You know, don't tell, you need to weigh me. Don't tell me the number because there's nothing I'm going to do about it. There's nothing, you know, I think that we don't want to pursue weight loss in any way as a goal. And because more often than not, it will also result in weight gain because our bodies are rigged to not have deprivation. Our brains freak out when they notice there are fewer calories coming in. So we really have to kind of accept where we land, which is tricky because if you come from a generation of dieters, you don't know what anyone's biological set point range may be for weight because everyone's been trying to manipulate it.
And there's been so much nonsense that's been put out there. I can't think of a better word for it. You know, instead of fat, they put sugar. Now you don't eat sugar. You know, your fats, there are good fats, there's bad fats. There's the carnivore diet. There's the one that you drink vinegar or something. Then there's another one and this and that and so on and so forth. It's bizarre. And then there were people who were saying, oh, but something like Fruit Loops is at the top of the pyramid. What are we talking about here, people? Get a grip on reality. Take a look at what you're doing and only worry about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And then what the message is. Again, a community, one person. It only takes one. And that's why we're doing this.
Exactly. And I think even I want to go back, if I may, about the, because I don't want to pile on doctors, because I think these issues are so systemic. Doctors get an average of, I think, 7 minutes with a patient.
Yes.
So it makes absolute sense that a doctor's just going to be like, let's do the numbers because I don't have time to talk to you for half an hour. I'm sure most doctors wish they could speak to patients for half an hour. But that's, again, the system that we live in. So I just wanted to add that point because I know that doctors are in many cases absolutely doing their best. I mean, my son is almost three. He had an ear infection a couple months ago. And the first thing they did was put him on a scale when he came into the doctor. Now I know with a young child, they want to see if they want to make sure they're not losing weight. Right. But, I can't help but think, oh my God, here we go. Here we go. Buckle up. Rest of your life, every doctor's visit, and I'm always sort of steeling myself for how I'm going to navigate that as he grows older, no matter what his body looks like. So that, we're not talking about his weight in front of him or his height or what's normal or what's average or where are it. I don't want him to have that in his ear on my watch.
Well, the thing is, you know about that. You've lived it. Yeah. And what we're trying to do right now is just get people aware that there is a problem, mm-hmm. that eating disorders are a disorder. That's why they have the terminology disorder. And it is part of mental illness. It's out there. It's real. So if you had one thing you could say to women out there, what would it be?
I want to say two, but I'm going to pick one. It's not your fault. It's not our fault. It's not our fault that it's like this.
It's very true. I like that.
I think we need to know. I think we have to have compassion for ourselves and each other because it really isn't. It could be trauma. It could be our brains. It could be this breathing the air we breathe of diet culture, but it's not our faults. And it doesn't have to be this way.
Well, we've got years and years and years of having it inbred in our brain that we're supposed to look like this. We're supposed to be perfect. We're supposed to be a certain way. And if we're not, then we don't care about ourselves. We're not taking care of ourselves. And, we're dismissed. One of the things that I think we should mention briefly while we're getting out of time is the fact that someone who is overweight can be fired from a job. Now, hello?
I mean, that's the thing. It can not just make you feel bad, which is dangerous, right? Because that stress of being judged or being made to feel bad, that stress is real and can cause depression, anxiety, or it can be correlated with depression and anxiety. But the fact that weight is not a protected class and it can actually affect your earnings, whether you are hired for a job, if you are fired for a job, that is a big deal because it's not just in the cultural air we breathe. It's in the legal books or not in them. And there are a couple cities in the state of Michigan that have introduced legislation to make weight a protected class. In Michigan, it's a protected class. New York City just passed weight and height as protected classes. And so that's a really, really important step because when we look at gee, why do I want to lose weight? Yeah, I'm seeing images. Yeah, my mother dieted or whatever the thing is. But it's also, it could affect your actual livelihood. It's real. It's really real. And that's what we keep coming back to. And I'm so happy that you feel the same way that I do about community. I mean, again, this podcast, this conversation, what you're doing, it's amazing because community and conversations are the way out. They're the way out. They're how we fortify ourselves in a world that is really, really, really making this difficult for us.
Well, Cole, the book is What's Eating Us? Women, Food, and the Epidemic of Body Anxiety. Fixing our messed up relationship with what we eat and how we look. Cole, where can people find out more about you?
I have a website, which is my name, colekasdan.com, and I'm on Instagram at colekasdan.
And of course, your book could be found at wherever they sell books.
Absolutely.
Cole, again, I want to thank you so much. This has been very informative and so needed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.